Up next on episode 40 of Stack Overflow, Joel and Jeff sit down with Michael Lope, a.k.a. Rans, to discuss how a geek manages other geeks, the dangers of working remotely, the pitfalls of offshoring, and some techniques for continual learning from IT Conversations. Hi, this is Phil Windley. Today I'm excited to bring you another great program from Stack Overflow with Joel Spolsky and Jeff Atwood here on IT Conversations.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media.
And now, here's Stack Overflow.
Yeah, it's just like you're playing with your AM radio and you just tuned in on a station that was in the middle of something.
That's awesome.
That's the illusion we want to create. We had an anemone die today.
An anemone?
Yeah.
What color was it? Are they all brown or green or what's the deal?
No, I don't know. It was like multicolored. They're like brown, green. They got little tentacles.
Does an anemone float when it dies, or is it just sort of sad and on the bottom?
I don't know. I found out about it by email. I haven't yet seen it dead. But yesterday it was looking really sick. That's our aquarium is a source of much sadness and stress. The people that visit our office, they only get like the, oh, cool, it's like pretty fish. They don't have to live with the...
It's not life.
They don't have to stay up with the sea fish that get the seahorses when they get a cold.
There was in college, I had a proctor who had the whole saltwater tank, and she had all of the maintenance of all that. And at some point, and I don't know what these things were, but she got these worms in the saltwater tank, and they got into the base of it, and they just slowly grew bigger and bigger, and then they started like climb up out of the mud and start eating the fish, which is like it's like wow. A horror movie in your fish tank. That just freaks me out whenever I think about it.
Does. So did they, become land animals like they evolved into?
I think at some point she said, they might win. So I think she, got the water out of the tank. But I can imagine them, my vision was always they were getting out and coming after you because, that's just kind of freaky.
We had starfish that would, just eat the other fish. Like, the fish would just go missing completely, and we were pretty sure that the starfish was eating them. So we got rid of the starfish. Anyway, Jeff, what's new?
Nothing. I was just afraid that with those worms, there was going to be spice involved and wouldn't be good.
Nice poll.
Yeah.
We have to our listeners, I don't remember, I don't know whether we've started recording or not, but to our listeners, our special guest star today is Michael Lope, also known as Rans in Repose.
Everyone gets that wrong all the time. They're like, it's Rans Responds. They Rans can't actually be that.
Yeah. No, so. Repose is like rest, right? It's like you resting.
Exactly. Chilling. Sitting with the little thought bubble above my head going, what do I think about that?
Right. Whereas, for example, Joel on software would be Joel in with arms akimbo. that would be my posture. Jeff, what are you going to be? You're going to be the coding horror, like that Edward Munch painting, the famous Edward Munch point painting. Oh. Also the Home Alone kid. You're slapping your cheeks, your mouth wide open.
Right.
Thanks. Thanks for being on the show, Michael.
My pleasure. Wonderful to be here. I should tell the story of how I know you. I started writing my blog a million years ago because you were writing so well, and I felt I had to, rise to the occasion. So this is there's something very. Circular, symmetric about this being here. So I'm very happy to be here with both of you.
Cool. And what do we usually do on the show, Jeff? Jeff, usually have some questions or something to talk about.
Well, sometimes we talk about Stack Overflow stuff. I know Joel has always been very deeply concerned that this would turn into a hosting show.
Oh, yeah.
This show.
Yeah, we don't.
It's very important that this show be about us.
That's right.
That's what I got out of this.
The special guest.
Yes. Not too much the guest. That would take away from our majesty somehow. But
right.
But No. It's
okay if our guests want to talk about what they think about us.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Once we can, I'll be the focus. That's the important thing.
So I turn it around and I ask you questions. Is that the deal? Is that what's going on?
I have a question for Jeff before we get started. It's just sort of off topic. This is a Twitter question.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so I can't understand like half of the things that people are tweeting at me.
Right.
So there's a guy named James Pierce. I don't really know who he is, but it looks like he sort of hasn't shaved for a while. And he wrote, @Spolsky has a follow-to-follower ratio of 1 to 100. So Twitter is a broadcast medium? ? Now you want to interpret that for me?
Actually, Michael, you've written about Twitter before. I think you're a Twitter fan. I remember some of your stuff about Twitter.
I'm a Twitter nerd. I'm actually writing about Twitter right now. But I think what he's saying there is that I'm actually pulling you up on Twitter right now, Joel. You probably have a huge amount of followers, and you have a totally few.
Yes, I followed 19 people, some of whom never post. I had to stop following Jeff because it was just all Jeff all the time in the homepage, and I couldn't take it.
So the guy's basically telling you that, you know, you're a jerk because you're not participating in the medium. That's what I hear.
Oh, I see, because I'm not following all the people.
Exactly. It's just you and, you know, on your stage and blah, blah, blah. My rule is pretty simple.
Yeah.
Is, you know, whenever I sit down to look at, I use Twitterific on the Mac, when I sit down, I got to be able to go and digest all of the updates that have come through. If it's a flood, if it's like Scoble's got like thousands of
followers. Yeah.
I just turn it off. It's like I'll stop using it. So I follow like a couple of hundred people and I sort of edit it. But it's people that I know, the people that I don't know, but it's a consumable amount between times that I sit down and I use it. So
that's exactly how I feel. And I sit down and use it every 3 days, so I want to see 3 days worth of it. And the trouble is that there are 2,475 people who actually like want to know like how many squares of toilet paper I use.
Right.
And I don't even know who these people are and don't care if they use a lot of toilet paper, a little bit of toilet paper, or if they just completely go without. Just don't care. I just don't. It's not because I'm a bad person. I just don't. Okay, so, I guess it is a broadcast medium, basically, when you put it that way. Either that or a sort of mass peeping Tomism.
Yeah. Yeah, I use search a lot to kind of see when I throw something out there, what kind of the response is. And that's kind of how I find, people that I know, that's kind of how I find the random, like, oh, this is a bright person that's saying something that I connect with. But it's, you know, it's a couple people a week, maybe. And I'm always taking people off as well.
Oh, you've got a huge ratio, too. I'm looking here. You got about a 1 to 50, it looks like.
Yeah, I'm a total asshole. Yeah. Totally. It's
1 to 200.
Yeah.
No, wait. Sorry. 1 to 20. You got a 1 to 20 ratio.
Hey, so I have a question for both of you on that very topic. Okay. So can you guys do math? Are you guys like mathematicians?
No.
And Jeff?
Definitely not. I'm clearly not.
I can type anything you want to Google.
Every programmer should have like a perfect math SAT score, so I've already failed.
I don't maintain that. I've just never met anybody that doesn't have 800 on their math SATs.
I have.
I'm horrible at math. I'm bad at time. I was like trying to figure out because I'm in Arizona right now, and I was like, 2 hours. Which way does the sun go? I'm like, I'm a developer, and I am awful at like math. And I was wondering what you guys thought about that. Why is that?
That was a question on last week's show, actually.
Oh man, yeah, I should have listened to him.
And the conclusion was that a lot of the stuff that this was the conclusion that I think everybody liked, which is that. The stuff that we call math, which is calculus, geometry, trigonometry, the stuff that's taught as math in most curriculum, happens to be just a stupid random selection of math that is neither interesting nor useful to what we do necessarily.
Got it.
With some exceptions. I mean, obviously you could use trigonometry to make games, right? But that there's this whole world of like sets and graphs and basically a lot of discrete math, linear algebra. There's just like all the other stuff that's going on in mathematics that nobody ever gets to because they get to calculus and their brains blow up and they never take another math class.
Right.
And they're missing all the much easier, much more interesting, much more relevant, much more fun stuff that actually does kind of apply to a lot of what we do.
Agreed.
Like logic is math, right?
I'm not that good at logic either. I'm okay at it.
But that's coding. I mean, it's sort of logic in a way.
Yeah, exactly. It's
like debugging is reasoning about things. But you're more about the you're a manager now, right?
I am a manager of humans. That's correct.
Yes. So, yes.
Do you say that implying that I don't code anymore? Because that's what I heard, man.
I've already gotten in trouble for saying that people don't code. recently. Well, do you actually code anymore?
It's very rare. I'm fretting about this in an article right now of how to like keep scratching that itch when it's just, you know, whenever I'm around my team, there's just a constant set of things to do that have nothing to do with code. So I like to say that I do strategy, which I'd love to say that I had a ton of time to do, but it's a lot of people stuff on a daily basis. I'm thinking 60-70% of my day is, you know, all the people related stuff, which I love and which is why I wrote the book in the first place, is trying to figure out how to get better at that.
John Devon, who was the lead programmer on the Excel team when I was back there on Excel, and there were 50 programmers on his team reporting to him. Mm-hmm. Actually, I mean, there were lots of smaller teams. They're usually these little bite-sized teams, but they all reported up to him, and he still made time. He just said, I want a 10% coding schedule.
Yeah.
So he made time, you know, one morning a week or something?
Right.
Where he just, like, took some small feature and worked on that.
I do that outside of work now.
I'm doing the math to see if 10% is one morning a week. But, yeah, it is. And he just took some small feature of Excel and actually just did it himself. As a way of keeping a hand in the code and keeping in touch with people.
I'm having even difficulty doing that. I do stuff on weekends. I go poke around languages. I'm looking at Scala right now. So, but it's really kind of just lightweight, kind of exercising the muscle, but not actually, you know, getting it in shape, if you will. Mm-hmm. So not all, it's mostly people now. It's all management of stuff and trying to grow people and people that want to be better engineers and people want to, you know, consider this whole management track.
I want to play a listener question, if I can figure out how to do that.
Okay.
Let's see how this goes.
Hi, this is Radha Mukai. I have a question about software management. What makes a great software development manager? Should he or she be a good developer to be a great manager? Thank you. Bye.
Short and sweet question.
Good question.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's like straight. I thought we'd like dance around it before we went to that one.
That's right. That's it, really, right?
Well, there's two questions in there. Do you have to be a developer to be a good manager? And the answer is, I don't think you need to be a great one, but I think you need to be. The only thing I always tell people is, and this is sort of negative, which is, I'm a pretty positive guy, but you've got to be able to know when you're being lied to. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, which is involves knowing the system, knowing the problem, knowing the product, whatever it is. So, you know, I think you've got to have to have been there. You've got to have experienced it. You've got to have been in the hell of shipping 1.0. So it's not just the coding, but it's the entire process of getting a piece of software out the door. So a good developer, I don't know of a lot of amazingly great developers that have gone willingly towards management. So I think they kind of tend to be, I don't know. I take that back. There's a couple of guys that have done it, but they've been forced to do it. They haven't wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. So the first part of the question was, what does it take to be a good development manager? My throwaway answer isn't really throwaway. Is I think there's a huge amount of just listening. It's just you've got to just kind of gather all of the data from the people, from the teams, all this stuff. I feel like I do a ton of my job is just sitting there kind of gathering data from all the people around me. So if you're one of these, you know, big ego types that likes to talk and isn't a very good listener, you're traditionally, in my opinion, not going to be that great of a manager because you're not taking it all in because it's all happening in the hallway around you or wherever it's going on. So,
and you're just pontificating and making speeches.
Which is fine. There's a time and place for that, but you're managing humans. You've got to be listening to what they need. My metaphor that I've been working on in my head for a while is like it's. And again, this sounds negative. I'm not a positive guy. It's weeding. It's like if you got a garden, there's just a daily tending of it that you have to do, and it's sometimes just really kind of boring. I'm gonna have a one-on-one, yada yada. But these things just over the time make the team happier, and I think it's part of being a good manager.
I can't even think of, when I try to think of one skill that would make you a great developer, that is the same as a skill that would make you a great manager.
Yeah, exactly.
They seem to be so completely non-overlapping.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, coding is very much about getting a machine to do your bidding and thinking rationally about rational objects that are going to behave rationally. And management is just the exact opposite of that. I mean, I literally found myself in the computer book section this weekend looking for a book. The ideal book would have the following title: Managing Difficult People for Dummies. Or even Managing Dummies for Difficult People would have been great. And I wanted it to have, like, chapter 3, the person who always wants to do their own little project in their own little garden and doesn't want to join the rest of the team. Chapter 4, the person who talks too quietly. Chapter 5, the person who talks too loudly. Chapter 6, the person. Anyway. But that's like a programmer way of thinking, like that there's this list of programs like in Stack Overflow, you can go ask a question and then everybody can answer and vote up the answers, and that's how you're going to solve your personal problems.
Yeah, I think that's like the big problem that you have is in software engineering management is it's like it's a career restart. I was just writing about this. You just go from, you know, this very understandable world of systems and, you know, it's a, you know, there are rules that you will follow and it will compile, right? And then you go into this world where it's like, wow, Bob's just bitchy on Monday, and I have no idea why. What's up with that? And what do I do?
You'd be lucky if you could narrow it down to just bitchy on Monday. You know, that'd be like, okay.
But it's that thing.
Monday, just avoid Bob on Monday. At least it's fixed. It's more like I don't know what he's so angry about.
Exactly. But it is. We sit there and we try to, as engineers going into management, we sit there and try to find the system. Okay, this is what it, this is the flow chart it applies here. And there's nothing. It's just people are incredibly messy, and that's the kind of the reason I did the book. Is it's like, okay, these management books, they don't bridge the gap from I was a good programmer to now I need to be a good manager. They just assume, hey, management skills, here you go, ready, fly.
And the book is called Managing Humans, mm-hmm. right? And it's published by A-Press. And there's also a website, managinghumans.com, which is sort of an introduction to the book, right? Oops, I hope it doesn't play music, because then there'll be music playing suddenly.
There is no music playing.
Cool.
Jeff, why is Jeff so quiet? It's kind of freaking me out.
Jeff.
Sorry, sometimes I try not to interrupt Joel.
That was
sort
Michael.
Of mumblingly interrupts me as I'm talking, and I always complain about that. He's like, no, I'm really listening. It's very interactive. I'm interrupting you.
It's called active listening.
So I try to avoid that. But the only thought I had there was that a lot of times my concept of leadership as a developer is, it's hard to scale it to a really large group. And I'm kind of curious, how big are the groups you're managing now? It sounds like they're pretty sizable.
I've moved into the senior management role, which is I'm managing managers, which is a whole nother ball of wax. So, you know what the next book's going to be called.
Yeah. Managing Non-Humans.
It's going to be called I'm Screwed.
But it's fascinating because it's more like management than engineering is like management, but it's a very different role where it's, anyway, we won't go there. So the teams, but teams are anywhere from, I actually have a magic number about 7, where I feel like that's sort of the point that you can get it all done. And over that, you know, given that the team's sort of normal, over 7 or so, it just turns into, it's just too many people, and people aren't getting the attention that they need to kind of grow and do that. So
I used to wish that you could have larger teams than that, where people sort of self-manage in a way.
Yeah.
I think I might have been being naive.
I don't know. So they're all in this 7, there's all those personalities you were just describing in terms of all those chapters and whatnot. And some of them need a lot of attention and some are self-managing. But again, at that 7 number around there, it gets to be too many. And whenever I see or inherit a team, it's like, how many people do you have? Well, I have 10. I'm like, well, how's it not working? And the answer is almost always, well, I'm not talking to so-and-so, or this person's about to quit. And you can go back to that, you know, it's this weeding thing again. People need daily attention. Not that they're needy, but it's just that's part of who they are as humans, as they want to be touched. That sounds getting a little weird there, but they need to have that sort of they need to have consistent attention, I think is the right word. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. How is it different to manage a team of programmers as opposed to, you know, what's unusual about software developers in management?
Well, this is hard for me to answer because that's all I've ever done other than the management side, which is again just more managers. So I've never like managed a bunch of cheesemakers or anything.
Like, yeah. So, but there must be some things you notice when managing developers and you're like, if you people were normal, I wouldn't have to deal with this.
Well, wait. That's everything. Michael talks about on his blog. I mean, that's like a geek, you know. He studies geeks. I mean,
yeah, I do.
Yeah, I do. So I think it's kind of an unfair question because you're managing the type of people that you are, you know.
Yes. Yeah. How is it different than managing other people, though? It's the thing that's popping to my mind, and stop me if I answer a different question here, is the thing that kind of made us good engineers or developers, where we're sort of these system thinkers. So I'm dealing with the thing right now with someone who's, you know, going to be fine with me talking about them, but it's just, I'm walking this person through a hard problem, and I'm trying to figure out how to get them through it. Mm-hmm. And I almost always attack explaining something to a developer very systematically. I tell them, this is what I'm going to say, and this is what we need to do here. And I, again, it's kind of building that flow chart for them to think about it. And that's almost the engineers, geeks, nerds, they like structure. Mm-hmm. So you put that in around sort of this messiness of us being emotional human beings and all that crazy stuff. And it's, that's something that I'd say not a trick, but that's something that always works with, well, you know,
that's true. No, you're absolutely right. I know from even having salespeople at Fog Creek that that's not the way it is for everybody. Like sometimes you really have to think about, like with an engineer or a developer or somebody who thinks is used to thinking structurally, like you say, you can give them the flowchart and they'll be happy, even if it's maddening to them in some way because they're personally coming off bad in this flowchart. They don't care because it's a flowchart and they're happy and they understand it.
Right.
Whereas with other people, you sort of have to, you know, often like the way in which something is presented is more important than the content of what you're presenting.
Right. The salespeople, that's an interesting one. That's they annoy the hell out of me. They're wonderful people that make lots of money, but I honestly do not. I know it floats their boat. It's money, but whenever I'm dealing with them, I just feel like I'm a fish out of water. It's like are we even speaking the same language here? It's incredibly frustrating, but something you learn as you kind of make your way up the management challenge is all those different corporate or, you know, organizational dialects.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michael, you wrote the Nerd Handbook, which was one of my favorite recent things that you've done. And I think the word I was sort of struggling to remember was anthropologist. You're sort of a geek anthropologist. You do this very, very well. I would say that's how that defines you. It's like you're really good at explaining this whole how do geeks work thing. And it sounds like that's the essence of managing geeks is just understanding them, right? Is, you know, and having an audience. I mean, you're not trying to manage, you know, butchers or bakers or, you know, whatever, but being a developer and actually understanding them. I can also appreciate the whole losing touch with, like, you know, because it says, like, the first line is a nerd needs a project because a nerd builds stuff all the time. And our first part of this conversation was, well, what have you been building, right?
Right.
If you're not building stuff, then you're no longer part of the tribe. And it becomes strange at that point.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, it's not just the being a part of the tribe thing. I think we as a species, whatever the hell we're demographic, is there's just such intense satisfaction of building that thing. And I'm sure we get this in all of the different industries or professions that we have. But it's like when you get that last line of code and it's like it's shaped perfectly in your head and you compile it and it just works. That's just the high, you know, and that's how we think is how do we build stuff. And that's why I always have 5 or 6 projects going on, because I'm just that state of doing something, of building a thing is just lovely. And that's the hard part with management, again, is you're not really building anything. You are building people, but there's none of that structure to it. It's all just kind of like, boy, I'm winging it. And I hope this works out well because I like these people a lot.
Right, and I think my concept of leadership as a developer, such as it is, I think I'm an okay leader. But first of all, I think I would never try to lead any team larger than like maybe 3, maybe 4 people, like at most. That would, I think, immediately exceed my abilities as a quote unquote manager. And then to me, management, the way I do it, and this might be wrong, is just basically it's leadership by example. It's like you try to do the things that you want other people to do. And you sort of, there's an implicit, hey, follow my lead. You know, I'm doing this. And then, you know, you're sort of opening the door and saying, hey, you should do it too. And really, that's about it.
Yeah, if that works for you. That works for you. Yeah, that works about one-tenth of the time.
Well, what do you do? What do you do when you become a manager? So you're right. That's kind of step number one. But step number two or seven, I don't know which chapter it is, okay, so you've been a manager now and you know how to program in C or whatever it is. And then you inherit the world's best programmer at something you have no idea about, right? That's kind of the next step is how do you can't lead by example. You've got to lead you got to figure out other ways to lead. So that's, you know, a whole different ball of wax.
Right. Well, because even with my little handpicked team, I've noticed that, and they do a great job, to be clear, but like I have to really be explicit about what I want. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I just assume that, they'll just know what I want and they'll see it and they'll do it because I'm doing it. And they don't always. Like, I really have to, like, sometimes explain to them that, let's do this, right? And I don't know. It can be very literal, right? I mean, the assumption is if you're leading by doing, then people would just follow in your wake, and it's like a row of ducks following the mama duck or whatever, and they just get imprinted and they follow. But it's much more hands-on than that, right? I mean, you have to be very literal.
I think there's one of the first mistakes that you make as a manager is you realize early on that your team can't read your mind, and I still do this. It's like I was thinking that. So how in the world did you guys not do that, right? I think there's this, you know, that's one of the first things you do as the screw ups that you do is you just kind of go, well, I wasn't abundantly clear, and I expected you to read my mind. What I found is a good way to get around that whole thing is having remote employees. This is a question. I was looking over the Stack Overflow, and I was looking at questions that I wanted to talk about, and one of them is kind of remote or the offshore question, all that sort of stuff, which you guys have probably already talked about. But that having someone not in the office, not in the hallway, but someone who's doing something that's critical for you, how you manage them, how you communicate with them is very different when they're not there and they can't see, you know, your body language and all that sort of stuff. And it teaches you more about what you need to say, even to people that are still there, if that makes any sense. You've got to be really double explicit about what they need. So it's one of the powerful lessons for me was having a big remote team and going, wow, I can't just like wander the hallways and kind of organically manage these people. I needed to put more process on it. And I hate process. Process annoys the hell out of me. But I had to do it because otherwise this team was not going to get done what I want them to do.
And sometimes, too, I think I tend to assume that people are good at the same things I'm good at.
Right.
And that isn't always true. And I think leading by example leads you into that trap because you're leading by example. You're out there doing like, you know, I do obviously a lot of writing and blogging and stuff like that. And I can't really ask these guys to do that because they're not really – it's not their thing. You know, they don't do that, you know, for fun. It's not something that they look forward to. It's not something that they want to do. And but it's very easy for me. So it's easy for me to just assume that, oh, you know, I should just go on there and start answering the blog entries. And, you know, it's just not natural for them. So, again, just, I guess, playing to your strengths and realizing, you know, your strengths aren't necessarily your team's strengths. So that's another failure of the leadership by example model.
I like teams that – I like teams that fill in my gaps. I like the, you know, I won't talk about my team. What I like about my teams are when they are totally different than I am. That's number one, where they have, I've got this super nerd who's totally cares about the thing we're doing and he's deep, deep, deep. And I've got the other gal who's, you know, more socially aware of the team and can kind of do the recon across the different teams and find out stuff. And it's like a nice stew of people. Those are the teams that I like is when it's kind of set up like that. So, and I had another point, but I just totally forgot it. I can't seem to stop thinking about how many squares Joel uses in the restroom. It just keeps on coming up.
Joel just had to bring that up.
We got a question from somebody that you alluded to, so let me play
that question.
Hi, Jeff
and Joel. My name is Alex Dalishaw from Atlanta, Georgia. I've been following both of your writings for quite a long time now, and I greatly enjoy the podcast. Please keep up the good work. My question to you is, what do you think about the feasibility of building a workforce out of people who work from home? I'm in the process of trying to grow my business beyond what is essentially a one-man show and get other people onto my team. I will admit that the angle from which I'm coming at this is a little orthogonal to software development per se, as I'm in the voiceover IP systems integration consulting business, but my ambition is to use that to build a product company somewhat like Fog Creek did. Anyway, while corporate America seems to be somewhat terrified of telecommuting on any large scale for the obvious management challenges that it can legitimately be said to impose, I just can't bring myself to justify dragging people into being stuck in some office for 8 hours a day. I think that most of the problems with managing people can be overcome through technological solutions, better back office and collaboration technologies, voice over IP, IM presence, etc.
Aha, good luck with that.
Certainly in some business models, it's easier to quantify individual productivity than in others.
Sorry to interrupt Alex here, but that's As soon as people start saying, oh, we can solve management problems using technology.
IRC. IRC is the answer. Give me a break.
Sorry. Anyway, I'll leave off the ending here, but Alex is starting a company in Atlanta that I guess is known for like not having any two people living within 2 hours of one another, just big, gigantic highways. Everything is spread out. Right. There's no place you can have an office where you're not dooming 90% of your workforce to, you know, spending 2.5 hours of every day stuck in traffic on a highway somewhere.
So I have a question for both of you, and we'll get to this question in a second. Is do you like going into work?
Yeah, very much.
And Joel's cheated, but
what?
Cheating is the way to do it.
What do you mean you cheated?
What I mean is you cheated by you created sort of a nerd playground.
Yeah. I mean, I made a workplace that I want to go into.
The way to do it. But I guess the reason I say cheating is because not all workplaces are nerd playgrounds like that. They should be. I get what you're getting at, which is like make your the place of work desirable, obviously.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. So two things. First off, one of the things as a manager you have to do is you have to make it, that's a great line, it's the nerd playground, right? You want to go in there and you want it to, yes, it's to be productive, but you just want them to be there because I think it's so much more efficient. However, I think with this remote thing, I've been worrying about this for years. We've got to figure out how to make it work. A lot of my senior guys have a house. I'm in Arizona right now with part of one of my teams, and they're here because they're great. We will bend over backwards for them, and so they're going to be here. So we've got to figure out how to make that work. There's no way that we're going to get them to move over to California. So, but it is, you know, it is a different team. It gets treated a little bit differently, and I think that's just going to happen more and more. I think there's going to be a lot more of this sort of remote development.
So I think I want to bring up, I mean, you mentioned the nerd playground, and I guess Fog Creek is supposed to be a great place to work. But for me, 10% of the joy of coming into work is that it's a great place to work, and 90% is that I love these people, is that I want to spend time with the people that are here. I've chosen a select group of people that I really like having lunch with, and I really like talking to. I really like having intelligent conversations with because they're all smart, and they're all nerds like me, and That's what it kind of is, and it sort of sounds like the idea of a team of telecommuters working from their home, it just sort of sounds like it's never going to get the group cohesion. You know, you're never going to – how often are you going to have lunch together? You're not going to be like a really, really tightly knit family.
Right. I agree with that. It is sad. I think you've got to have the individual off by him or herself somewhere. I worry a lot about that person, and I think they get shortchanged in terms of stuff to do, and they get kind of, you know, designed out of the cool stuff because they're not there in the hallway. So the way that it's traditionally worked at other companies that I've had is it has to be a pod of people down in wherever the elsewhere is, right? You know, so they can get together and they can do that social thing. But it's a tricky problem that I don't know if I've cracked incredibly well.
Yeah. And Jeff, how did you crack it? Because you've got people the people that you're working with on Stack Overflow are never in the same place as you.
Well, again, I think I cheated, and I think a lot of times you cheat, and that's why you make things work, and you sort of leave out all the details, like, oh, you just, you know, get all your best friends from your previous jobs. I mean, I knew these guys intimately from working with them for a year plus each on previous jobs. So we had
in person. You knew them in person from these.
What's that?
You knew them in person, like you had been working with
them?
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, we worked together in person for at least a year, if not
so
more.
It's certainly possible if you have a long established relationship with somebody for that person to go off somewhere, maybe work from home for a while, you know, move to a different city and continue working on the team maybe if they – but I found – and I feel like there's a I certainly have enough personality defects that I can barely even – like convince people in the other hallway. Like I don't even know what's going on with people that are in the far hallway. I can't get them to do what I want, let alone, you know, if they're going to be off in some distant location. And other people don't seem to have this problem. I mean, there are plenty of people that are just good at, I don't know what it is. It's the email and the IRC and the VoIP. They're able to keep on track, I guess.
Is that a generational thing, though? Is that a Generation X versus Generation Y? I lean in your way, Joel. It's like I actively try to find what every medium can do to kind of keep people together. But at the end of the day, I would prefer everyone to be in the same wing of the building so we could just get it done.
There's too much like nonverbal. There's too much nonverbal communication.
Yeah,
that is not the words that would be mentioned in IRC.
Right.
It's just too tedious to send an email or even to have a phone call. You're just not going to get it. You have to set up the phone call. There's just a certain amount of friction to working with somebody remotely that means that the bandwidth is just much, much less than when you're working with them. And I don't know how many times something when you're working with somebody in the same office, just having them right there and being able to, I don't know, see if they're unhappy about something or notice that they're not coming in on time or...
To solve the problem right then and there as opposed to having this whole thing about it. Yeah, I totally agree with that. Is Stack Overflow...
Go ahead. Let me tie these two concepts together. So maybe what I would recommend if to the caller is if you're going to pick these people, have some sort of offsite where you all go for like multiple days, ideally.
Yeah.
And try this out and see if you actually work together in person and can get some sort of rapport going in person and then break apart. So maybe this model would be, you know, come together, break apart, come together, break apart, and just have these regular intervals where you actually do come together in person. I think that could work. But I think you have to have this in-person relationship to really make the remote relationship work. I think it's sort of a catch-22.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay. Yeah. All right. We didn't get to any we missed the Stack Overflow news section of the podcast. Jeff, is there any exciting Stack Overflow news you want to
No. Report? Well, there's always Stack Overflow news.
We got that sure. Bounty. The bounty thing is working.
Yeah, we finished the 7-day, the other end of that feature. So, Michael, the funny part of that is we have the 7-day feature where if you don't like an answer that you've gotten or you haven't gotten a good answer, you can sort of slice off a piece of your reputation. Say, "This, I want this so badly. If someone can give me a good answer, I'll give you a piece of my own reputation." And the funny part of that, which I'm sure you'll appreciate as a person who manages programmers, there was a 7-day timer, and at the end of that 7 days, stuff happened. And we just finished that 7-day part, like, 2 hours before it was going to expire.
Before the code ran.
We sort of deferred that work. We're like, oh, we don't have to do this for 7 days.
This is like the train has set off from Chicago on its way to St. Louis, but the track is not all down yet. But by the time it gets to St. Louis, we'll have the track. We hope.
Exactly.
So the train doesn't have brakes either. The brakes have been shipped ahead to St. Louis using the Pony Express. They will throw them at the train as it arrives in the station and get installed at the last minute.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
About badges. I was perusing your site, and I think the badges thing is one of my favorite things. I play World of Warcraft, which is you know the bane of my existence. But this whole sort of achievement system that you have here, I was wondering what like unexpected thing has occurred. And I'm looking down this sort of list of badges that you have, and some of them are very obvious, and some of them are like, whoa, that's got to be hard to do. But what is something that's happened where you're like, well, we didn't expect that when we did badges?
Let me look at badges. There's a bunch of things I like about badges. So badges are pretty much explicitly modeled on the Xbox achievement system.
And there you go.
Which I've talked about before, but the interesting thing about the Xbox achievement system is it works on several levels. It works for like beginners, it works for intermediates, it works for experts, and it draws all three of those audiences in to the game. Like you learn about the game and you get rewarded for doing stuff, which feels good. And it was amazing how effective it was at such a broad spectrum of gamers. And so that's why we have those three tiers, like bronze, silver, and gold. Those are the three audiences, beginners, right, intermediates, and then like the hardcore people. So I'm looking at the badge list. So another thing I like about it is you can look at the numbers next to the badges, and it sort of tells you what people are actually doing in the system. This is a way for us to see how many people have actually posted a question.
We don't have a single generalist or specialist.
Well, that's more laying down track.
Okay.
The badges that we haven't fully implemented yet. But those are the last two. I mean, all the other ones are basically implemented except for, I think, yearling, which is you have to be on the site.
I like the part that's amazing is that there are 20,000 people that have answered a question and gotten an upvote for their answer.
Yeah. Well, exactly. You can just break down the stats.
That's really the very active community, right? Because those are the people that come regularly that aren't just Googling on by to get an answer to their question that they found in Google.
You need a mystery badge. You need like the badge that no one actually knows what it is, and the engineers have to go reverse engineer why they suddenly got the mystery.
You could just call it lucky and give it to 20% of people at random.
That would drive them up the wall.
Oh, unlucky! You know about the way to improve the overall luckiness in your town if you're a monarch and you want to. Improve the luckiness of people in your town. You just kill random people. I'm killing you now because you're unlucky.
That's right.
That's right. So probably, and this is going to sound really obvious to you, the thing I learned from badges is that anytime you give somebody an incentive, they take it very, very seriously. Like, they take it more seriously than you do. Not that I don't take these features seriously, but, you know, again, it's like, it's weird to be outside the game creating it. You look at it differently than when you're participating.
The participants are actually a very malleable world
where anything can happen, and, you know, these things are very arbitrary, but from the inside, it doesn't look that way at all. It looks like these are very strict rules. I have to understand them. You have to explain them to me, you know, and you just get a lot of questions, and people are very serious about, why didn't I get this? Or, you know, why does it work this way? You know,
right.
They just take it really seriously, and it's hard to think of it that way from the outside. Like, the people who create WoW probably think these rules, you know, all the WoW stuff is really, you know, on some level kind of silly, but...
But it's sort of these, you know, it's sort of this world where money doesn't matter anymore, and we've got to find some other system to kind of value each other. So that's kind of cool.
It's actually, we think that, you know, it's not that money doesn't matter, and that we could have done this with real money. There's no reason we couldn't have, and if we were Jason Calacanis, we would be. But
careful. If you say his name too much, he'll appear.
He's going to sue us, yeah. but that's because we really believe, and we really decided that having a real reward system displaces, like, giving people monetary rewards makes them actually put a monetary value on what they just did. So, for example, you know, I solved some person's problem last night with VB, and I got, you know, a few little upvotes, and he wrote, "Thanks, that really helped." And, you know, I spent 15 minutes doing that, and I got a lot of positive feedback, and I'm happy, right?
Right.
Because he said, "Thanks, that helped." And he didn't even give me the little check, the little, like, "This answered my question."
He didn't accept your answer? That's so uncool.
Yeah, well, I think he knew. But whatever. I got all the stroking that I needed. But, I mean, how much money could there have been there? 16 cents? And then I'd be saying 16 cents for 15 minutes, not worth it. You know, as soon as there's a real amount there that's like a currency amount, then that almost displaces your – I believe that displaces your motivation somewhat. It just kind of replaces your motivation with, like, is it really worth the 15 cents? And you get a very different kind of contributor.
Right. Well, this is, you know, geek anthropology. It's understanding that the metric, the thing that geeks enjoy more than anything else, is showing off what they know. And it also feels good to help other people. I mean, it really, really does. Like, I told Joel, one of my favorite things to do on the site is go to a post and I'll read all the answers. And I look for people that have just entered the site. Like, they have a reputation score of like 1 or 10 or some two-digit number. And they'll post a good answer, and I click it up. And it just feels really good to reward people for doing awesome things, you know? And that's geek anthropology to me. It's like, that's how we work. You know, we just want to see other people do cool stuff. We want to do cool stuff and build cool stuff. And, you know, it's just sort of the virtuous cycle of, you know, encouraging people to do the right thing.
Yeah. It's a great idea. Is it doing well? Is it doing gangbusters?
It's doing gangbusters.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's definitely exceeding expectations.
I always like to go into Google Analytics and brag about all the fantastic data that we have. But 4 million unique, 4 million visits in the last month, 11 million pages, 11 million page views, 2.2 million unique visitors per month. And that actually kind of surprises me, because I've heard the statistic bandied about that there are about 4 million programmers in the world.
Interesting.
So to have 2.2 out of 4 million, actually, I don't know where I heard that statistic, and I guess I don't know what that means. I mean, it's, and I wish somebody knew and could tell me. But I have heard confirmation that it's around 2 million in the U.S. by whatever, you know, the IRS, I guess, puts out some numbers, or the Census Bureau, or I don't know who it is, the people that claim they're... obviously, it's a real loose number, but 2.2 million is a huge number of people that actually visit the site every month. And that's in
about
3 months that we've built up to that.
I'm kind of bummed this wasn't around when I was, like, super coder, because this wouldn't have saved me, like, time.
Yeah. Most people, at this point, most people, like 82% actually, are typing a question into Google, and then we already have the answer for them. And that's how they get to our site.
Oh, really?
So that's actually our most common use case, is you type the question into Google and there's already an answer for you.
In fact, that became a complaint about the site. In fact, it was so effective that people were getting PO'd that you'd start typing an answer, and by the time you were done, there were like three other answers, and they were complaining that it was actually too effective. So we actually we do a little callback, like when you start typing an answer, that kicks off a little Ajax-y thing. in the background that actually goes out and looks for new answers. So it'll tell you, it's like while you're typing, oh, there were three new answers, and you can click to load. And it's what they call the fastest gun in the West problem. This was a huge topic of discussion on the site. It was like, how do we deal with the fastest gun in the West problem? And at one level, I was like, how is this bad? You know, it's like, I'm getting answers too fast. Make it stop.
No, it's like that you made the effort to try to rush in on an answer, and somebody else beat you to it.
Yeah. I mean, this is not a bad thing from the perspective of the person answering the question at all. So it's kind of tough to judge.
Right? I think the right thing to do if it's a popular technology, if you think other people are going to answer it, you really want to snag first, is just bang out the fastest two sentences you can that kind of would get the person on the right track. That
first.
You know, yeah. Not just the word first, but like, you know, have you considered blah, 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 without sample code, without anything. Just bang it out, and then go back, and then take some more time to edit your question, to add sample code, to test your sample code. Like, if I publish sample code, I've tested it usually.
Right.
Well, this is where it becomes more like a game too, and parts of the site really are explicitly designed to be around. It's supposed to be fun. It's not supposed to be a game that's arbitrary, but it's supposed to be fun. And part of having fun, and again, geek anthropology, we love leveling up. That's like our favorite thing, right? Equipping items and leveling up, it's fun to do that. So we encourage that because I think the net result is something that builds your career, builds other people's careers. This is sort of a net positive, whereas playing World of Warcraft, it's like that time just disappears from the planet, basically. But if you do something in Stack Overflow, other people can find it, other people can benefit from it. I mean, this is a totally reasonable way to spend your time, in my opinion. But it becomes gamesmanship. It's like, how do I give the best answer? And you're gamed into really kicking ass and answering people's questions. I mean, how is that bad? I mean, you know? And somebody wrote me this really nice email about how using Stack Overflow had taught him to be this really great writer because he learned every time he wrote something what didn't get upvoted, what did get upvoted, how to write good answers. And he felt like it literally had made him a better writer. I thought that was amazing. I mean, I couldn't ask for a deeper compliment.
If I ask a question, is there like an RSS feed? How do I know that I'm getting feedback from you guys?
Well, if you ask a question, we actually just introduced this new feature. The site, as long as you've actually asked a question, we have an account for you, quote unquote account, which will be cookie based and sort of attach it to something more permanent. But every time you go to the site, if you carry that cookie, we'll go out and query and see if there's any new answers or comments on your question. And there's a little envelope next to your name that lights up. We also have an RSS feed per question, so you could certainly subscribe to that. That's at the very bottom of the page. It's also in the HTML header.
Michael, do you have any favorite questions you wanna bring up for the show?
I know we actually kind of covered the one that I wanted to bring up, which we talked about, which was sort of the offshore remote thing. Okay. So that was the one I had. So
all right, cool.
I wanted to talk about that one.
We'll go around. Did we talk about that enough? Offshore. Do you want to talk about offshore? Remote.
Well,
I guess it's sort of the same.
The question I had one point that I wanted to make. I don't know if it's a favorite question, but the question was, what is it? Does offshoring work? And my issue with the question, it's a fine question, is there should be double quotes around what does work mean, right? Because
there's some value of work.
and there's some great answers on that question, mostly about misaligned expectations and whatnot. And I think there's a lot of people that think offshore works just fine because they spent less to get a thing. I'm doing air quotes on almost every word I'm saying here right now, but it's.
I can hear it. I can
spend less to get a quote thing.
But it's to me, it's like. Work to me is as an engineer is, did we build this beautiful thing that was totally awesome, right? Mm-hmm. And in that case, offshoring doesn't work for me at all because cost-wise, even with great offshore teams, I tend to spend a lot of time dealing with not awesomeness and a lot of suckiness and whatnot. So there's people that it works where it's, when it's, something which is simple and it's easy and it can be described in a flowchart sort of sense, but it doesn't work for me because the cost is almost always the same amount as the people that I would have here. So work is the issue I have with that.
That's something that people who haven't studied economics don't quite get, which is they look at the salaries in, like, say, India, for example, and they're one third of the equivalent salaries in the United States. And that is actually the total burdened cost of hiring an employee in India would be about one third. And they just sort of assume that that means that's because, say, the cost of living in India is lower or whatever. Right. And actually, that's not why. The reason is because you get one third the value, because
exactly
the people paying the money for these developers have to buy three times as many. to get the same effectiveness out of the Indian developers. Not that they're not good, but they're far away and they're in a different time zone, and they're you know, sometimes they aren't as good as the top ones that, that you could get locally, and that's why. And the truth is, if people were getting just as much value out of Indian developers as they were out of local developers. And once again, not because they're Indian, but because they're remote, and also they just don't have as much shrink wrap software experience and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But if they were getting the same amount of value, then there is no reason that the Indian developers couldn't charge that much. The price would be bid up, and it is on the great ones. The price would be bid up to the point at which it would be sort of equivalent, and they would be getting all the benefit of the low cost of living in India, as opposed to Walmart getting all the benefit of the low cost of living.
My big issue has to do with sort of what is their skin in the game. You know, back to what we were talking about, geeks and nerds, and sort of like how fun it is to level up. I find that when teams are they're there, it's their code. Mm-hmm. They know where it's going. They know why it's important. Mm-hmm. I get a very different result than I get out of teams where it's like, here is the spec, here's the API, right? It's just that their skin is in the game. So the productivity is through the roof. It's a totally different scenario for
yeah.
me.
Yeah, that's a good point. And actually, one of the things, I mean, I don't understand why India has, or so many developers in India have just chosen the offshoring / outsourcing model. Why don't they start software companies? They got all the skills. And some of them are, and that's what they're going to have to do, and that's how they're going to make the big bucks. And they're going to get excited, and they're going to be able to deliver wonderful things for people.
Totally agree.
Not by like looking for the low end stuff that's easy to get into. Maybe it's a good start for their industry, and maybe the next stage. But you know what? Like look at Israel. Israel just skipped the whole offshoring stage and just jumped to making products, and they're now, you know, a great source of innovation in software and technology. And the cost of developers in Israel is very close to the cost of developers in the U.S.
Yeah,
that was always me that they were going to claw their way up the ladder. That eventually there's going to be enough pressure on their salaries locally yeah. that it would stop being so, you know, such a great idea to do this offshoring model and have the low cost value model.
So there's that's about offshoring here. Jeff, do you have you want to pick a question from the site?
Well, mine is obvious because somebody on Twitter already said that I was going to do it, and I have to self fulfilling prophecy. But I enjoyed this one because the title is "I was recently asked for my Stack Overflow rep score in a job interview. Is that appropriate?" This is 502-492.
And this is sort of that's not the real question. Is not it. Is it appropriate, but isn't this funny that...
Well, I think it's a serious question, though. That's the thing that's a little scary about it is that, I mean, obviously we want Stack Overflow to be successful. We want it to be useful to people. But it does make me actually a little bit uncomfortable that it would be the focus of a job interview question. I mean, no, maybe if it was
for
fun.
You know what happened.
Yeah,
they were
the
like,
context.
Hey, so what do you do on the internet? You know, where else do you hang out? Are you on... Right. You have your own blog? Are you, oh, I like Stack Overflow. Oh, really? What's your rep? Okay, right. That's
it might have
a
been
conversation.
Just a very friendly.
Yeah,
and the impression I got, and I think somebody followed up with them in the comments. I'm clicking through here, and I think the people from the interview were just like fans of Stack Overflow, so they had, you know, it's just one of those friendly things. It wasn't like, you know, enter your score here, and then that's how we grade you.
But
I don't think that was the context.
You know what? We've hired people, or you know what? We've not hired people, but we've moved them on to, you know, we've moved them on from the resume stage to the interview stage because of top coder scores, because of winning ACM programming competitions. I would if somebody had a high Stack Overflow score and they applied for a job here, I would look at what they wrote. I would look at four or five of the best things that they did, and that would make a huge difference in whether or not we brought them in to interview them.
Right, and you bring up, I think, the best point here is that that was always the intention of Stack Overflow, was to leave this trail of breadcrumbs showing how awesome you are, right? Mm-hmm. It's about other programmers, about how great the average programmer has all this knowledge locked up inside them that doesn't really get out to the world because, like I said, they don't blog. They don't, you know, have this star complex that we have where they want to be out of
right.
time. But they really know their stuff. You know, and I've worked with so many talented developers, and that's awesome. Like, if you can go to Stack Overflow, hey, you know, I have a Stack Overflow rep, and the hidden part is because I have some really great answers, right? I have really great knowledge that I've shared with my fellow programmers.
We basically, what we did is we made about 20,000 Raymond Chens, right? Because every Raymond Chen blog post starts with a question like, how do I do the following thing in Windows? And then has what would have been the number one Stack Overflow answer.
Right. right? But you know, I'm a fan of the average developer. I mean, obviously not every developer, but you know, that was one thing that came out of my blog, was that the average commenter knew a lot about the topic that I was talking about, and often I learned more from the commenters than I learned from the blog post itself, and you know, let a thousand flowers bloom sort of thing. So I think if you want to highlight your score and point to, you know, some great answers that you've put out there, I think that's totally appropriate for a job interview, and I think great fodder for, you know, vetting somebody.
Think about how, you know, people like, have you ever, you know, even when you just go answer something on Stack Overflow, you ask something on Stack Overflow, you post a comment on some blog somewhere, 10 minutes later, you're there fidgeting, twitching, trying to see if it's caused a ripple in the world in some way. Has anybody even noticed this? Will somebody please just say good job, or that's really funny, or I appreciate this post or comment, right? People just crave that feedback. And you think about the average developer's job consists of sitting and solving problems all day long and not getting that feedback, just in a very lonely way. Even if they're working with a team of people, they're just banging out the code and they're solving a million little problems, and they're getting a little bit of feedback when they finally get a feature done and they demo it, you know? But just for like, oh, God, how the hell do you – I finally fixed that thing in my registry where it was taking forever for Internet Explorer to go to a hyperlink, you know? And you never get anybody to say, oh, good job. But you just spent 2 hours solving a problem. And so sort of that's kind of one of the awesome things that sort of happens on Stack Overflow, I think, is that all that unsung knowledge that you're earning as a developer –
it's microfeedback.
Finally has value. You know, it's finally worth something to somebody, you know? You've solved some really tiny problem. One of the great use cases for Stack Overflow is you post your own question and you leave Stack Overflow for a while, nobody answers. You go back and you do the research and it takes you months, you finally solve it. And then you say, you know what, I'm gonna contribute this back to the community. You go answer your own question. And now there's this thing that the other 30,000 people that are gonna have this problem will find on Google till the end of time.
Well, even if it's the other 30 people, right? That's the
even if it's 30,
group.
Right.
So yeah, no, I'm for it. The what about you, Joel? Do you have a question?
Yeah, let's find one. How about okay, this is a random one. The question is, what do you do to keep learning?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Constant learning. When my children tell me that they hate school, I often tell them they need to get used to continually learning, because they live in a generation in which constant learning will be required. How do I know? Because I live in a generation and work in an occupation in which continuing learning is imperative. I guess that's our field. Do you agree with that? And what do you do to keep up with it?
So my issue with learning is there's air quotes around it.
No, there wasn't in the original question.
There's this thing about nerds that I love, because I am one of them, which is like, we're really good at kind of like going really wide on something. It's like, oh, what the hell is this about? And you have Google and you have Stack Overflow, and you can just kind of like go really, really wide on something, which I think is awesome. And we're really good at finding those things. But I think the question is, how do you really kind of go deep into a thing? How do you not just like get like 2 inches of knowledge? How do you get like 16 feet of knowledge into it? My strategy, I always read. I've been reading since I was a kid, and if there's one thing that gets me altered, it's reading all sorts of crazy stuff. That's the thing that I feel like I'm doing the most learning. The job is always totally, you know, different, and there's always crazy things happening. There's a lot there, but that's what I do. It's not, and I'm learning there, and I'm gathering stuff. But it's, I think the outside of your comfort zone is where you is what learning really is going and finding out what, you know, what crazy thing you want to find out about. So reading is my thing that keeps me sane and keeps me learning.
And the top two responses, both the accepted answer and the community accepted answer, the number one item in those, the first
read.
Word,
yeah.
Read.
Yeah.
Do I get a badge?
So yeah, I think geeks think alike. This is what I'm saying. Yeah.
The trouble is that the stuff that's available to read these days, is, except for your book, Michael, it's just getting worse and worse. There's so much crap. I don't believe how much time I spend just going next in Google Reader and just being fed these little drivets of randomly useless information. We were having a conversation yesterday at lunch, and I noticed that about half the conversations at Fog Creek Lunch are usually of the form, did you see that thing on the YouTube with a guy with a cat, and the cat was... It's like
that's
we're
awesome.
This community that just uses like RSS feeds and Google Reader and Reddit and Dig and Twitter and whatnot to just sort of like munch a little bit, just surf around in this huge, gigantic junk heap, like a huge trash tip, like a gigantic dump of garbage. And we're all walking around, And I'm like, oh, did you see the other day that kind of that rusty kitchen sink that was sort of arranged in a funny way? And the guy's like, oh, with the dead cat? No, the dead dog. Oh, yeah, that was cool.
Right. I totally agree. You want to go deep. That's my whole point is, like we're really good at staring at those sinks. It's like, okay, well, I want to go learn how to make, cheese. How do they do that? Mm-hmm. And really, spending, I think that's what I'm pinning myself. That's learning to me is like, you go deep,
And then it's the practice, right? And then it's like really spending hours and hours and hours practicing to get good at it.
But yes, exactly, the focusing and all of that. But it's also the thing about learning how to make cheese is you sit there and nerd again here, right? And you find those rules and that system in there, and you go, cool, I didn't know that's how they made manchego. That's fucking hot. And then you go, I could totally use that in managing people. I'm not sure what that, relation would be. But again.
Well, if they like cheese, then you can bring them cheese and be.
But that's always how I'm thinking. That's one of the things that I motivate myself on, going deep on random things, is I always find that, gem of whatever it is that actually I can pull back into what I do all day.
Do you think there's, have you ever worked with a developer that spends too much time learning and is always about code specifically, like they've always, every 3 weeks they come in with some new faddish way to write code. And they're like rewriting everything to use something. I won't mention anything because I'll get sued. But they got it with some completely.
Wow. That's what Inside Geek for you.
Wow.
they come up with some new fashion of the day kind of form of programming thing. And now they've stopped everything. And they're like, no, this is fine. I'm just going to rip out all this stuff. And I'm going to rewrite all this stuff from scratch. And I'm going to and in 6 months, it's really going to be worth it because our code is going to be completely upside down.
This feels like therapy for you, Joel. What's going on, man?
Well, to be fair, sometimes Joel says stuff, and I don't agree. I think you skipping .NET was silly in retrospect.
Skipping .NET?
Yeah. The way you were such a late adopter of .NET was just silly. But in general, I agree with the theme of what you're saying, which is developers are like magpies. They got to have the shiny thing, and sometimes to the detriment of what they're actually trying to do, they're so...
They're working really hard on this new shiny thing that they want to learn about because there's learning involved. And a lot of times you'll see, it really depends on the kind of company, but there's an awful lot of companies that will they'll switch programming language for no reason, rewrite everything because it's just impossible to get the developers not to.
Well, wait. Let's tie that back into management. The reason that happens, in my opinion, is because the people managing don't have the technical chops to tell developers are just getting led down these crazy, paths that they shouldn't be going in. Yeah. And they're like, oh, wow, we got to do this technical thing because the technical guys said we have to. Mm-hmm.
So let's not put all the blame on the managers here, but I agree with you.
No, we'll just fire them.
There's also the other half of this equation, which is the whole magpie thing, the bright and shiny thing, which is I think it's part of the geek sort of psyche to be like, oh my God, that's the new hotness. It's Xbox 460. It's it's whatever, that's our nature is to go and embrace the bleeding edge and understand it and go figure it out.
It's true that you say that, but I'm always one generation behind on everything. Mm. I was like a year late to Twitter. I was 2 years late to .NET programming. I was, what else am I late to?
I think you want developers that are a little bit cranky because if they're too optimistic, optimism kills, right?
And yes.
Yeah. Optimism tied with the magpie is really deadly. Right. It leads to some really fun stuff, but it's like you'll never get anything done. So I think you want developers that are a little bit cynical, not too much because it comes a downer. I think you do need that.
Yeah.
You want the really, really bright conservative guy or gal on the team where it's just like they know it and they get it, but they're also able to they're not afraid of change, but they can articulate the cost of change, I guess, is the way to think about it. They balance the magpies out and they go, oh, yeah, that could totally screw us up for a year. Let's not do that.
That is, I think, one advantage of getting older as a developer is I think you do get enough failures under your belt.
Yes.
Honestly, I think that's what it takes. To really understand some of the pitfalls, deeply. And hopefully you have enough people like that on your team. That's the danger of having these really young development teams, in my opinion, is they haven't had enough failures.
And you got to do it.
And
you've got to go get beat up, and management or engineer or whatever. You got to go. Some of my best stories are colossal screw-ups, and they're awesome, and I learned a ton. And I wish I didn't have to do them again, and hopefully I won't.
Oh, yeah, no, failure is great. I mean, in fact, I don't know if we've touched on this, but I think the people who come to you and say, here's all the ways I've screwed up, are going to be some of your best people because A, they're reflective. They actually think that they screwed up. and B, you know, they understand the value of going in and taking this and, you know, preventing it from happening again. I mean, that's the nature of software development. It's very iterative. It's all about failing and then saying, how can I not fail the next time? Yeah. And if you're not doing that, then you're kind of doomed.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just going to wrap it up, but go ahead. Give us something to make people cry as the music plays on the way out.
Oh, crap. A lot of pressure. I think that what I look for when I hire engineers, it's a balance of two things. It's first off, I look for a little ego. Do you know what you're talking about? Can you really explain it to me really well? But I also look for that humility thing, which we're talking about here, which is, boy, did I screw up. And these are all the lessons that I had. Those are the two things I'm looking. And they're sort of contradictory because the big ego person, I'm not interested in hiring the big ego person who can't tell me how badly he screwed up. That's what I want to say.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That's a great balancing. That's a perfect way to phrase that. You want they balance each other. You got to have that. Totally.
Absolutely.
Great.
This was terrific. You have been listening to episode number 40 of StackOverflow.com. Is it really already episode number 40?
Yeah.
The big 4-0. Whew, we're in middle age at this point. Our guest has been Michael Lopp, who many of you know as Rans of Rans and Repose. You can visit him at ransandrepose.com, and his awesome book is called Managing Humans. Just search for that, Managing Humans. That's pretty much all you need, right? That's those two words. Thank you very much for being with us, Michael.
It was a pleasure, guys. It was awesome.
Thanks, Jeff. To our listeners, if you have any questions you want to ask, next week we have Uncle Bob Martin, Robert Martin, the object-oriented design guru extraordinaire, will be a guest host if we can find him. And if you have any questions about that, or if you have any questions about this week's show, please call the podcast hotline. This is where I type Stack Overflow into my contact manager to try to find the phone number. Or record an MP3. The Stack Overflow hotline is 646-826-3879. And you could just call and record a 90-second or less message, or record an MP3 and email it to us here at podcast@stackoverflow.com. And we do get a lot of those. And so we try to get to the good ones. But keep them coming in. We do try to listen to them all. There's a wiki that we use for a transcript, and that is very beneficial for when we're getting into a debate over what was actually said on the show, or even better for the hearing impaired who want to be able to read the most exciting parts that went on. So if there's a part of the show that you particularly liked, just a minute or two or three, please contribute by going over to the show notes at blog.stackoverflow.com, and you'll see a link for every show. There's a link to the wiki, which you can just hit the edit button and provide a little bit of a transcript of what we're saying here. What other things do we usually announce at the end of the show, Jeff?
I think that's it. I think that's you covered it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much, and see you next week.
Bye.
You've been listening to Stack Overflow with Jeff Atwood and Joel Spolsky.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Joel Spolsky. Our website editor was Jeff Atwood. The series producer is Jeff Atwood.
This is Phil Windley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great presentation from Stack Overflow here on IT Conversations.